Greetings and salutations, everyone. I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm net control operator for the Limark Technical Net. Been going strong for over 43 years. And every Sunday night at around 8 o'clock, we sit in front of our radios and we chat with each other. We educate, inform each other, learn from each other, and hopefully entertain each other. And I thank you again. Yeah. Anyway, thank you everyone, almost everyone, for coming by at this 8 o'clock and listening to the net again and hopefully participating on the net. Let me drop for a second and I'll give you the usual links. Okay, if you want to reach me via email, that would be either for mailbag questions that you can't ask on the technical net because you're not in radio distance, or if you have a topic for discussion of a scientific nature that's in the news and you'd like to share your expertise, or if you have a TechNet puzzle that you'd like to offer. They're as rare as hen's teeth, but they stimulate discussion, and usually they're loads of fun. So if you have some technical puzzle that can't be very quickly Googled the answer, then please send it to me, and I'll take a good look at it. And if we use it for the TechNet, I'll give you credit. That's all I can do for you on my present budget here. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder about a space and NASA-related story. Now, you can contact him directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. My email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. One sec. Okay. Wonderful time to get a phone call. Anyway, if you have... as always, I cut and paste interesting articles throughout the week, and I put it up on a link page and make it available to everyone. So you can get to it by typing into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you access to that. And it's open 24/7. Now, we also have a chat room. So if you want to get onto the chat, it's a little quiet tonight, but you can get to it by typing in chat.ac2gs.com. One sec. I really have to turn off my telephone. I'll be right back. Okay, getting back. We offer an audio stream on the internet of the technical net, and I leave it open for the rest of the week, for most of the rest of the week. Occasionally, I have to reboot these things. So if you're wondering what's happening on in Glen Oaks, you can just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. And as always, I'd like to remind people that MikeAC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. And it has archives of this technical net that go as far back as September 2006. So avail yourself the wisdom of people who have either moved away from the area or have passed away and become silent keys, unfortunately. Let me drop for a second, and I will tell you what we got planned. Okay, we have pretty much a vanilla episode. I don't have any particular opening words of wisdom. AI continues to do its thing, but incrementally, and there's more rumors of things than there are announcements of things right now. So when those rumors become actual announcements, maybe I'll discuss it here with you people. We'll begin with the usual questions and topics and conversation of technical concepts. Hopefully the first few questions will be amateur radio related, since this is an amateur radio repeater. But we are open to discussing all aspects of science and technology if you're so inclined. That should take us to approximately 10:15. Paul WS2N will then join us for the SpaceNet report, which should take us to approximately 11 p.m. when I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's the plan. If everything continues to work and I don't get shut down by all-star connections, some weeks it's perfect and other weeks it's less than perfect. So with that in mind, if anyone has any questions or topics or comments to be made of a technical nature, please hit that push to talk and ID yourself, give me your first name and your call name, call sign.
WA2VDH, John, with I guess two questions and possible comments also.
Okay, John recognized and is on the list, number one. Anyone else want to join him? Did not.
Okay, doesn't.
So, okay, I really, other than did you hear me, I didn't hear anything else per se, but I know you have some things to talk about tonight, so I'll put you on the list. Anyone else want to put their names on the list for tonight? Any questions or comments or topics for discussion that you'd like to be involved in? Okay, hopefully people will have some questions or comments or topics later on during the net. We'll see what develops. John, what's your questions and your comments?
Okay, yeah, fine business. First one, about the WOW signal. I thought I remember reading something, I don't know if it was on Apple News or something in passing, where they had an explanation for the WOW signal. I vaguely remember it, something about, I think they said it was some kind of maser-type action in hydrogen gas clouds that generated a fairly narrow band signal right around the hydrogen line frequency, I think 1427 megahertz. I was wondering if you heard anything about that. Good.
Well, I heard pretty much the same thing that you did. They have a good reason. Is it, you know, is it legitimate? It sounds legitimate. I'm sure there will be other groups who will look over their results and make their own comments, the nature of science being what it is. But I haven't heard anything more complicated and involved than you did, John. But that was about, I think about 4 months ago. Matter of fact, I think Lou, NY2H, mentioned it on one of the TechNets.
Yeah, maybe I must have missed that. Yeah, I do remember reading something about that. The interesting thing about that is it's one of those types of phenomena that have been done in the laboratory and yet have seemed to have occurred naturally, where it was like a maser action, some kind of feedback, natural feedback mechanism occurring in clouds of hydrogen gas. I remember a similar story years and years ago where they said that this was more of a geological thing, where they said a vein of uranium, I think it was in the African continent, had under natural processes gone critical and actually started like a naturally occurring atomic reactor. This was years ago, though, in I think it was Scientific American. My other question, other comment, was about this, and this I do have the article from, it was in Science News, about the Starlink satellites generating, giving radio astronomers a grief. I know they're giving optical astronomers a lot of grief, showing up as streaks on photographs, but it's also affecting radio astronomy, too, I heard. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the entire astronomy field is kind of upset, to say the very least. There are assurances from Starlink that they will take measures to improve the situation, although they keep on piling more satellites into orbit, which I don't see how that's going to make the situation better. I think they were discussing different ways of shielding the satellites against these RF and optical side effects that astronomers are unhappy about. But all of that so far I can perceive is some lukewarm promises. So, again, I think the astronomy profession is kind of upset. Also, the fact that other agencies are kind of going to copy Starlink, and so there'll be even more satellites. It's unclear exactly if they'll be in the same exact orbit or some margin away from them, but it's probably going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah, I just don't understand how one person can be allowed to raise that much havoc with already established, you know, scientific investigation processes. But that's a whole other story. Okay, that's pretty much it. Roy, thanks for the time.
No problem. We live in interesting times when a lot of things don't quite make too much sense to me personally, but we'll see how it settles out eventually. Thank you, John, as always. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? We got a lot of free time, apparently. Of course, we do have Leslie, but I was wondering if anyone wanted to join him on the list tonight. Okay. As always, I try to explain to people that this is not a show. This is a net, and it lives and breathes on the interaction of participating people. So the idea of sitting back and listening and having fun is all well and good, but it requires a certain amount of participation. So, once again, I'll kind of ask everyone to kind of, think into themselves and say, can you participate on this net and make it a more enjoyable, more educational experience? So, contemplate that, and when Wes and I are done with his subjects, hopefully you guys will have something to either ask or discuss or bring up or what have you. So we will go on to the next person on our list, which is Wesley.
I'm really sorry, guys. I bet you didn't get me. It checked in at the very beginning. It's Kilo Delta 2, Romeo Echo Kilo.
Yeah, I didn't hear you at all. I'm terribly sorry. Okay, what's your question for tonight?
Wesley's next. You didn't hear me, so we can go to Wesley if you wish. Whatever you choose, please let me know.
This is Ham Radio. Why not?
Brian, Wesley was kind enough to offer you the next turn, so you're on.
Thank you, Wesley. Always appreciate it. Roy, I appreciate everything you do all these many years. A big thank you. First question, I have a satellite, a CNS, CSN digital satellite controller. It's hooked up to a ICOM 9700. Both pieces of equipment work well. The next portion that's hooked up is the satellite antenna itself. That's working great. M squared was awesome, and everything's beautiful, with the exception of the azimuth on the rotator section, the needles bouncing on the controller. I was just wondering, you guys have been around a lot longer than I, on, you know, in regard to ham radio, if you happen to know what that was. It's bouncing between north and south. I was heard that there may be an encoder problem in the rotator itself. Over to you.
Okay, not ever having a rotator that was designed for satellites. Hopefully someone listening tonight does. It sort of also depends upon the mechanism. I guess if it was an older model, the indicator of position is probably more a potentiometer than a servo. But, you know, we live in modern times. So it probably, I would imagine, is some kind of damage to the servo mechanism, the encoder, rather, the mechanism. You know, maybe something needs to be replaced or fixed or something. I hate to make the usual kind of comment, but did you call the manufacturer and sort of ask them what they think you should do? Is it in warranty, most important?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm calling tomorrow. I had called HRO. I had bought it on 8/24/24. I installed it only a week ago, and there's nothing they can do for me. Wonderful. So I'll probably just buy a whole other set, send this into Yaesu, because I don't want to be down, and then we'll take it from there. I do thank you for your input. May I ask the next question?
Sure, Brian.
Thank you. In order of, and this is not to offend anybody, I just don't understand the organizations. If you would happen to know the order of, it's a tough word to use. I'll use the word professionalism, but I don't want to insult anybody. I may be using the wrong word, the order of professionalism or the order of importance, again, not to offend anybody, of Aries, Rhesus, and Mars. What order would you put them in?
I would tend to consider them kind of like apples, oranges, and watermelons. I don't really, unfortunately, I might be totally wrong, but I don't see, well, number one, Aries and Rhesus are both ARRL organizations. So my sensibilities have always been that they're parallel agencies. The one is not in command of the other. Mars is a is an entirely different creature. Mars doesn't operate on amateur radio frequencies. Mars is the military amateur radio service, but in and of by itself. It has its own frequencies, and its organization is purely armed forces, as far as I know. So you got an armed forces organization off to the left. You got two parallel organizations ultimately run by the ARRL. But again, I don't think they cross over, except on occasion. But I don't think there's any command structure that has one in front of the other.
Oh, great. Thank you for the input. I really appreciate it. And again, I appreciate all you do. Keep going strong, and have a great evening. I do sincerely wish you guys a big 7-3. Thank you again, Wesley. KD2LEK will be listening.
AC2GS. Well, thank you, Brian. I appreciate your participation and your kind words. So I thank you. And I'm sure that in the weeks to come, you'll have more questions or comments for the net. I appreciate all that you do. Wesley, Unless there's someone else out there who I missed also, because I don't know why, but I'm listening through the All-Star link, and I guess some are not kind of channeled or occasionally timed out by something. So we'll give you one more chance before we move on to Wesley. If anyone else has any amateur radio-related questions or comments or topics, please let me know now. Okay, well, Wesley, you're on.
Thank you very much. Hello, Maritime Gout.
I don't know what's been going on. I should have heard Brian, but I did not hear Brian. So I don't know what blocked the All-Star link transmission that he initially sent. But who knows? We'll see how things work as time goes on tonight.
I just want to make sure that I'm being heard without a problem, or you want me to increase the power a little bit?
Well, it probably would be a good idea to increase the power a little bit. It's not necessary right now, but it might be necessary soon.
How it is now?
Sounds fine.
I'm going to leave it at 40 watts right now. Okay, so we have five topics in here. One is ham radio related, although it doesn't sound like. So the first, it is mostly to Paul, our space professional. Japan, the world first wooden satellite. If Paul would like to comment on it.
Wes? Yeah, we talked about this a while back, but they finally got the space. And the theory is that, you know, wood is not going to be affected by a vacuum, so why not? So, you know, to the International Space Station on a cargo vehicle, and at some point they're going to put it through the little airlock that they have on board the space station in the Japanese Kaibo module. You know, they put it through this little airlock that closes the door behind it, and there's a robotic arm that grabs a hold of it on the outside. Specifically a robotic arm built by Japan, not the big 57-foot one, the Canadian arm. This one is specifically made for anything that leaves the leaves or something that they want to retrieve from the ISS. You know, small. You know, it has to be, you know, microwave size, not too big. There is another airlock that they have called the Bishop airlock that they could use if it was bigger, but that isn't used that often. But we'll see how it works. I'm not sure what the wooden satellite is going to be used for. I haven't read up on that yet. You know, is it going to just be used for taking pictures or anything? I don't know. You might have more on that than me at this point. Back to you, Wes.
Yeah, scientists at Kyoto University expect the wooden material to burn up when the device re-enters the atmosphere, potentially providing a way to avoid generating metal particles when a retired satellite returns to Earth. So it would be one of the reasons for it. But also, the Kyoto University made a deal with the big local timber company. And actually, those were the people who were financing the build
of the satellite. As it was mentioned tonight, there is a problem for astronomers to properly see the objects at space because of Starlinks and other debris that is there. So Kyoto University thought that particles of their satellite, they don't want it to add to the junk around, and it could negatively affect the environment and telecommunication, so they decided to make it from wood. But whatever is the reason, it's always money behind it. So you could correct me, Paul, if I'm right. What they say is each side of the box is like experimental, the box like experimental satellite of that Lingosat measures about 10 centimeters, which is 4 inches. So it's an extremely small one. And it was launched at SpaceX rocket, NASA, Kennedy Space Center, Florida, by Kyoto University Spaceology Center, and that's all I know about it. Back to you.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, it's probably just one U, and it's 10 by 10 by 10 centimeters, you know, 4 foot, four inch cube. That's, I guess that's all they sent up. I thought it was going to be bigger than that. Anyway, if it was launched by SpaceX, it probably went up on a cargo vehicle, because what I read, it was going to be put on the International Space Station, and then a crew would eventually launch it from the space station. But that's it. Back to you, Wes.
Okay. Another subject to you and to Dr. Roy's aerogel. Used by NASA to the lightest solid in the world. I believe I sent it to you as well. So aerogel is the lightest solid in the world that has been studied by NASA due to its exceptional insulation properties, with density approximately 3 milligrams per cubic centimeter. So imagine that you have a solid material that has 98% of density of air inside. Okay, yeah. and it is used for spacecraft installation, launch vehicle installation, cryogenic application by NASA, and so on. If you have a few cents about it, Paul, please, and then I'll be appreciating if Dr. Roy takes a cent.
Yeah, I remember when Stardust went up in late 1990s, I guess 1999, and I used to get on this net before there was a SpaceNet report, you know, talk about the space program and when Dick was on K2RIW. I remember that thing went up, and we talked about the aerogel size. It was about the size of a tennis racket, and it was on a satellite that was going to go up to the comet Vilt 2. The comet is spelled Vilt, W-I-L-D. It's pronounced Vilt, though, from the guy that discovered it. And Vilt 2 was, they wanted it. Take a picture of they want to take material from the comet tail. So Stardust went up, rendezvoused with it years later after launch, and it had this aerogel tennis racket thing that opened up on a hinge, and when it got near the comet, it would pick up particles. Particles went through it. It would would just leave a path. You would see the path that this came through. From that, they could actually see how fast it was going, the direction it was going, and at some point it would actually stop within inside the aerogel. So eventually, this catches bed type of thing folded into a descent module. And a couple of years later, when it came near Earth, it sent the descent module down to Earth in the Utah Proving Range, and scientists got a hold of it. Sure enough, that all worked. And that's how far back on this net we actually talked about aerogel 25 years ago. The mothership, Starship, Stardust itself continued on, by the way, let me drop it. That must have been the end of the ID, I just heard. The mothership kept going, after it sent the descent module down to Earth. Naturally, didn't have the aerogel anymore, but they gave it another job. They sent it off to Temple 1, another comet, or not a comet, correction, an asteroid that had the path of, I think, around every 6 years, it would go around the sun. So they matched the speed with that, and it rendezvoused with that, and they got pictures, data from another piece of asteroid. So comet, the asteroid, they were able to get extra science out of Stardust. And it's still in orbit today, going around the sun. It's in a heliocentric orbit. But the aerogel was very successful. They use it for insulation and stuff too as well, I saw the video that you sent, and they show the properties. You can hit it with a torch, and the other side you don't feel anything. What's interesting about when they send it to space, like you said, it's 90% air. Let me drop it. 98% air. When it goes into space, that there's vacuum up there, so you have to especially make the aerogel when it does go into space. The air factor, it changes things, when it's exposed to a vacuum, so it pulls differently or whatever. So I know they spent extra time, making really special, good, good product before it went up. And who knows what that cost. But it's a good deal. They use it for insulation inside of, I believe, some of the rovers that are on Mars as well. Inside they have the webs. They call it the warm electronic box, and they need to be insulated, protect all the electronics that are inside the Mars rovers. Back to you, Wes, WS2N.
Yeah, Wes, you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Yes, can you comment on the aerogel?
Okay, it's a very interesting, state-of-the-art material.
Unfortunately, it's still very, very expensive to manufacture. It's been around for decades. It has amazing qualities. Occasionally, you will see some real smart guy on YouTube be able to fabricate, a couple of grams of the stuff. It's impressive, but not really a kind of industry that any of these guys could go into. It's a very weird thing. It's basically a gel of silicon dioxide, which we know is glass and sand, and it's all over the place. But you can form it into a gel in an alcohol solution. Then the big problem is getting rid of the alcohol. If you just let it evaporate, or if you kind of force it out with a little heat, the entire gelatin structure will just kind of fall in on itself. So they have a clever mechanism. They use basically liquid carbon dioxide. And some people should say to themselves, what do you mean liquid carbon dioxide? They're solid and there's gas. In normal one atmosphere, you don't see liquid carbon dioxide, but you do in the pressure chamber. You can rev up the pressure so that the carbon dioxide is supercritical. It's in the phase between liquid and gas. It displaces the alcohol and gives you an opportunity to flush the alcohol out of the environment of the gel. And then you can lower the pressure and the liquid carbon dioxide will evaporate and leave you beautiful aerogels. They're still brittle. They're very sensitive to all kinds of ways of screwing them up. But they have amazing qualities and they're worth their weight in gold probably. Probably more than they're worth in gold. I haven't really checked the prices in aerogel because it's mostly air, weighs an infinitesimal amount. But a fascinating material that science has known about for decades, and it would be great if someone clever thought up a way to mass produce the stuff because it would be incredibly useful in general use. You know, just thermos bottles alone would probably benefit from them a great deal.
I was thinking, why is it being called a gel? It behaves like a glass, although it's 1,000 times less dense than it.
Comment.
Well, they call it a gel because in the alcohol solution, it forms as a gel. It's only when you draw off the alcohol that it takes on the interesting structure and function that aerogel has been known for lately.
There was a comment.
WA2VDH. Roy, question on that aerogel. I take it that would probably be dangerous to inhale any particles, causing silicosis, I take it, right?
I would assume so, although generally speaking, you're not supposed to really. It's very brittle, and its effectiveness is lessened by having it break into pieces. So I would assume that the people, and it's very expensive and very few people have it, so I would assume that most people take the proper, use the proper masks when they're using that. But I would agree with you. It can produce very, very fine particulates that can go deep into the lungs and cause inflammatory processes and such. But again, I think it's thankfully, in a way, so rare that most people who are having anything to do with it know the dangers and mask up for any kind of insertion, removal, what have you, processing of the material.
I see. Thanks, Roy.
I was amazed with the thermal conductivity of that material that is ideal for trapping heat and protecting sensitive equipment from extreme temperatures. I assume that is why it was used in spacecraft like, if I remember, the Stratus mission capture.
cosmic dust particles. I'm not sure. Paul probably knows better. Paul?
Yeah, I'm not sure of the question on that. But I did see the YouTube that you sent, and according to that guy, they would like to use this for capacitors as well. It's such great insulation if you'd be able to use it for that purpose. I guess I've never heard of it being used as a capacitor, but they did have that on the YouTube. But I wasn't sure of the question just then.
It has been used in spacecraft like a Stratus mission to capture cosmic particles, talking about aerogel, right or wrong?
It was the Genesis mission that went up, and it went to the L3 location. I'm trying to think where it went. Anyway, a million miles away from Earth, and it was picking up particles from the sun. But I don't know if they used aerogel on that one. I'd have to check. They brought that back, and then that was the one that also went to the Utah Proving Ground, and the parachutes didn't open properly. They had a relay set in the wrong direction. It really was an accelerometer, and it was set in the wrong direction. When it was installed, so the parachutes didn't open up, the thing hit the ground at like 250 miles an hour, cracked open. The scientists were able to save the lab specimens that they needed. But, I could look that up in 1, 2, 3 and find out if that had aerogel in it. It might have. It had something to capture the what's called the solar wind, the particles from the sun. But outside of that, I would say Stardust was the only one that I know that they actually used to bring particles back from the comet back to your way.
A question to you about cryogenic application. So what I was able to read was that NASA uses aerogel to insulate equipment operating at extremely low temperatures, ensuring efficient and safe operation. So it's not only high temperatures or low temperatures, but it's also fireproof. I was just thinking, why nobody use it for drones wings? Doesn't have to be the drones with the 4-ton-4 motors placed horizontally, but vertically for the airplanes or airplane. I'm talking about airplane models. Back to you.
I think what Roy said. Every it's so expensive to make this stuff. That might be the problem. Don't know. Back to you, Wes.
Yeah, Dr. Roy, how the aerogels having 98% of air behaves when the water is that the rain is dropping on it?
It deteriorates. It's very fragile, and that's why it has to be pretty much enclosed, because a lot of different things can erode it. Why it requires such a sophisticated means to remove the alcohol solution that the gel is embedded in. And it's ridiculously expensive. You can go on eBay and such, and you can get little bits of fragments because it's very brittle and prone to break off. So sometimes if they need something a certain size and they break it, they'll sell the little bits and pieces at a loss, and so it's regular people can just barely afford it. But otherwise, to make it in the forms that they need for whatever they're using it for is ridiculously expensive. So, you know, it would be like gold plating an airplane for whatever reason. You know, it might be beneficial perhaps for something, but I mean, it's just cost prohibitive.
Okay, thank you very much for that. I wonder if there are any questions about this subject. Okay, we can go to the next one. So, batteries. We discussed batteries many times, but I have a story for Paul. And I sent the links to Dr. Roy and Paul. I've got a response from Paul about nitrogen, nickel and hydrogen batteries that could be extremely good for storage, as a storage for solar panel plants. So at the time when we have no sun during the night time, we could use the stored energy instead of just not having that energy because we didn't store it. And it's extremely good. It is good for 30 years. There are, of course, problems with it, but the only problem is cost. Any comment, Paul, about it?
The hydrogen, nickel hydrogen batteries. Not nickel metal hydride batteries. The batteries are different. But these are the nickel batteries. They've been around, again, when the International Space Station was being developed, they decided to put them on that. Hubble Space Telescope has them, or had them. One of the missions, I think they swapped them out for different batteries. The International Space Station had, a tremendous amount of these cells on board. Each cell produced whatever voltage it was. So they ran them all in series and parallel to get the voltages and power that they needed. And then they hook up the solar panels to them to recharge every 90 minutes. The space station goes around the Earth, so roughly, 45 minutes daylight, 45 minutes nighttime. So these things have to be charged and discharged. Thousands of, I think 20,000 or 30,000 times would be just average. So they needed that capability, and they could do that with these. Problem is the pressure inside is around 1,200 psi to keep these things functional. You would think that would be dangerous, but it's actually not. And none of them ever, blew up or anything like that on the space station. But what needed to be done, they're very heavy, by the way, relatively heavy compared to lithium-ion batteries, and physically bigger, too. So as the time went on, it was time to change out those batteries. They decided to use lithium-ion. And over the time, around combined 10 launches or so, they launched new batteries up, new lithium-ion batteries. To develop the same wattage, the batteries that they sent up were half the weight and took up half the amount of space. So everything was much smaller and lighter. And they would disconnect these. They were, not one at a time, groups of batteries, battery packs, and each one is like 400 pounds, they heavy battery packs. The astronauts would disconnect them. The robotic arm would store them for a while. And the new spacecraft would come up. And then they would eventually install those batteries into the same locations that they took them out. And they were on the truss. You know, the truss is 11 sections long. The different locations on the truss is where these batteries were located. So each one involved in a lot of spacewalks. Probably a half a dozen spacewalks to do the whole job. Over a period of around 3 years. But they finally got them all done. You know, they had some problems and issues. They had to put jumper cables on them, you know, big, heavy jumper cables that were needed because, you know, you would take out, let's say, 12 batteries and replace them with six. The other spaces would be blank. They needed to connect jumper, let's call them jumper cables, from one to the other, you know, to complete the circuit. That all needed to be done. And it took many, many EVAs to do that. Anyway, it all worked out in the end. The Japanese would send them up on the HTV cargo vehicle, which they don't send up anymore. You know, that's been retired. But they would send them up on that. And then they would take the old ones and put them on a cargo vehicle and then deorbit that, orbit the South Pacific, let them all burn up. So that's the story with those. Back to you, Wes.
So for solar panels, small application, doesn't have to be small, but not a humongous one. Also, there was found that installing big air tanks where the energy is pumped, I mean, the air is pumped under pressure to the tanks. And during the night time, due to air compressivity, that energy could be used without interruption. There's another method of it, but I was thinking about solid metallic hydrogen. So solid hydrogen at low temperatures 14K, but we have a space. So minus 259 Celsius is not a big deal, I believe. Dr. Roy and you could correct me, please. But of course, we have high pressures on it. In those conditions, the hydrogen's molecules H2 are packed closer together, causing the material to become rigid and crystalline. If I remember, the density of solid hydrogen is 0.076 grams per cubic centimeters. That was right. And the melting point is 14K Kelvin, and boiling point is 20.3 Kelvin. Metallic hydrogen is hypothetical, so I wouldn't rather try to be caught on that term. Dr. Roy, please, your comment, if you could.
I'm not exactly sure what you're getting at. The technology nickel hydrogen batteries operates at room temperature, doesn't require metallic hydrogen. I think it tends to would probably complicate the chemistry if it was metallic hydrogen. So I'm not quite sure what you're getting at.
I was speculating on low temperature hydrogen in space used for the purpose of battery. That was my speculation. Does it make a sense? Back to you.
Well, my understanding is that the nature and the reason, among many others, that they picked nickel hydrogen is that its operational temperatures go very low and pretty much very hot. So it's not that sensitive to its environment. So it should operate on a spacecraft. I don't think it requires or has episodes where the temperatures are so low that they're going to be complicated by turning into metallic hydrogen. You know, space isn't absolute zero or anything close to it. So I think space alone, you know, the temperature should be fine and there shouldn't be any metallic hydrogen involved in the batteries. The problem is that they're very expensive and they have a lower energy density than lithium ion, which is probably why everyone kind of jumped at lithium ion or variants of lithium. So is it possible for future, you know, to develop less expensive nickel hydrogen batteries? Yeah, and then possibly it would be an acceptable option for power stations that require rechargeable batteries. At this point, I think it's still a niche product for the space program and a couple other interesting places. But and it's certainly not a good option for the consumer, either for cars or for iPads or what have you. So, you know, it was purely if any place find a place at power stations.
DDH with a question.
Sure, John.
I take it that in this type of battery, both of the plates are made out of nickel, and as the reaction proceeds, one of them turns into nickel hydride, and then the recharging process, I take it, would separate the would turn the nickel hydride back into metallic nickel and free hydrogen gas.
Yeah, that's my understanding. You know, all batteries are essentially redox reactions, reduction oxidation reactions that are reversible. So, yeah, that was my understanding of the underlying nature of metal hydride batteries.
Yeah, that's all I remember of that is Leo goes or something like that. Anyway, okay, thanks, Roy.
You're welcome. Back to you, Wes.
In one of the applications for the batteries, they found hydrogen in porous metal. So the problem with storing hydrogen was solved by porous metal. So the hydrogen is trapped in porous material. They use different methods for its absorption, where the H2 molecules can absorb onto the surface of the porous material. That would be what metal organic frameworks, the porous carbons, through the weak van der Waals forces. And this process occurs at moderate temperatures and pressures. So porous structure of the metal materials that is kind of spongy. Yeah, I could use the term spongy of metal forms is being used in those batteries. I'm not a chemist, so I cannot make any claims in this area. I understand that it's a chemical bonding. In some cases, hydrogen can form the chemical bonds with the metal surface, or that is leading to its trapping. And that can happen when the metal has high reactivity or when the hydrogen is present in high concentrations. But correct me if I'm wrong. Thank you.
Yeah, AC2GS. We kind of talked about this a year ago when you brought up there was this research group that was talking about embedding hydrogen into strips of metal and using that as a safer method of transporting hydrogen from one point to another, because it would exist as an inert, stable hydride that required massive amounts of laser energy to free the hydrogen ion. So in these types of cases, it's kind of very reminiscent of when you used to talk about electrolysis, because water has a lot of hydrogen in it. The problem always goes back to is the means of storing it energy.